BodyPositivePortland.org or MarieEquy.center. It's March 30th from 12 to 6. Drop by anytime. We're going to be wearing masks, so it is COVID conscious.
Yes.
And it is 18 plus.
Thanks so much. We've been talking today with Jamie Love and Lady V of Sex Positive Portland.
Thank you for listening to Trans Positive. Thank you, Jamie and Lady V, for being here tonight. And everyone, have a good night, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Logan,
Colin,
and Jeremiah,
and we are Amnesia, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15th, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all of the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Right now, trans voices are so important. You know, they're trying to deny that we exist. And so to let us speak, to hear our voices, to hear what we have to say, I think is absolutely crucial. If you can motivate people and get them okay with persecuting one group of people, you can get them okay with persecuting other groups of people.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Wasias. The U.S. Navy throws trans sailors and Marines overboard. Colorado's conversion therapy ban goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And a trans philosopher fights oppression. Those stories and more this week, now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 15, 2025. The U.S. Department of the Navy's plan to expel Navy and Marine Corps personnel with a history of gender dysphoria are in high gear. New guidelines ordering the involuntary separations of trans service members after March 28 were announced just a day after a federal judge and a Trump administration lawyer clashed over the policy. A March 26th deadline for voluntary separations had already been declared. Waivers may be considered, but only for applicants who have lived for 3 years as their birth assigned sex and who never have and will not attempt to transition. Navy Secretary Terrence Emmert echoed the Trump administration's stance in his memo, saying, "The Department of the Navy recognizes two sexes, male and female. An individual's sex is immutable and unchanging during a person's life." Meanwhile, U.S. District Judge Ana C. Reyes sharply criticized the administration's justification for the policy in a hearing earlier in the week. The openly lesbian judge appointed by President Joe Biden presides over one of two legal challenges to the ban. Reyes chastised the government for its failure to provide evidence that transgender service members negatively impact military readiness. In her words, "The question in this case is whether the military, under the equal protections rights afforded to every American under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, if the military can do that and targeting a specific medical issue that impacts a specific group that the administration disfavors." Reyes is expected to issue a preliminary injunction against enforcement of the ban by March 19th. That would be more than a week ahead of the Navy Department's separation deadlines for transgender enlistees.
I first want to start off and say, at its very core, drag is art.
Transgender Representative Zoe Zephyr was eloquent this week when the Montana State House was considering whether to label drag performances inherently sexual.
Drag is a beautiful art. Drag has a deep history in this country, and it is a history that is important to my community. You know, if you are a woman in this body wearing a suit today, you are challenging gender norms that existed long ago. And in some ways, drag does work to challenge those norms.
The proposed legislation would have mandated fines of up to $5,000 per performance and allowed parents or guardians to sue drag performers for allegedly harming their children.
Drag story hours I have been to here in Montana, they are like Disney princesses reading to people. We had people come in and talk about this. These are spaces where people come up and they sit down in libraries and parents elect to bring their children and learn about books and the love of reading and also, yes, be involved in part and to hear stories told from members of my community. That is important and that is beautiful, and I do not think that we should be standing up and saying that this art form, because it's somehow connected to my community, is not allowed.
After listening to Montana Transgender State Representative Zoe Zephyr, 13 Republicans joined all the Democrats to reject House Bill 675. The final tally was 44 in favor and 55 against, with one Republican absent.
Colorado's ban on conversion therapy is going to the United States Supreme Court. Plaintiff Kaylee Childs is a licensed professional counselor in Colorado Springs, arguing that the ban violates the Free Speech and Free Exercise clauses of the First Amendment. Her original 2022 filing claims that under the law she is forced to deny voluntary counseling that fully explores sexuality and gender to her clients and potential clients in violation of her and her clients' sincerely held religious beliefs. Virtually every professional medical and mental health organization in the country disagrees with Childs. They've all discredited the assertions of religious practitioners that sexual orientation or gender identity can be changed through counseling and prayer. They find the so-called therapy to be ineffective at best and at worst, life-threatening. Lower courts have ruled that the state has the power to set healthcare policies and regulate its professional providers, and that the law does not infringe on free speech, as Childs alleges. An appeals court subsequently backed those decisions. Childs is represented by the Religious Right Alliance Defending Freedom, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has designated as an anti-LGBTQ hate group. The Supreme Court is expected to hear this case during its next term, which begins in October. Colorado is one of 23 states and the District of Columbia that bans conversion therapy. A high court ruling in favor of Childs could effectively overturn all of them.
Australians are highly opposed to transgender people being scapegoated for political purposes according to a new poll commissioned by Equality Australia. The country's leading queer advocacy group released its data as right-wing billionaire Clive Palmer pushes his transphobic campaign ads. The Redbridge Group polling was conducted between February 3rd and 7th with a sample of 1,013 Australians aged 18 and older. Among its key findings, 91% of the respondents agree or strongly agree that transgender people should have the freedom and choice to live their lives in ways that make them happy. 81% agree or strongly agree that trans people deserve the same rights and protections as other Australians. 86% agree or strongly agree that trans issues should not be part of the political dialogue during the federal election campaign. And 89% agree or strongly agree that LGBTQ people deserve to live with dignity and respect. Redbridge director Tony Berry said, "Australian voters are in the market for policies on cost of living relief, housing, and public and private health. The major parties cannot allow themselves to go off message with self-indulgent culture wars because that's the dog that isn't barking." Equality Australia CEO Anna Brown, "It's clear from this polling that the vast majority of Australians don't want to see trans people used as a political punching bag." Trans Equality Council Chair Teddy Cook confirmed the obvious, saying, "This polling shows that what is important to the Australian public is the cost of living and not trans lives. Trans people are busy contributing to our communities and getting on with our lives. Talking about gender and obsessing about a vulnerable 1% of the population won't help pay the bills or find a home."
Finally, the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Relations Subcommittee became a battleground against Republican resistance to the existence of transgender people this week.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Subcommittee Chair Keith Self kicked off his hearings with an insult to the country's first transgender congressperson, Sarah McBride. McBride swiped back at the Texas congressman's intentional offense. Then, her fellow Democrat and ranking member Bill Keating of Massachusetts stepped in to rebuke Chairman Self.
Ranking Member Keating, also wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?
Yes, we have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply...
What is that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?
I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency? I've come to know you a little bit, but this is not decent.
We will continue this hearing.
You will not continue it with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way.
This hearing is adjourned.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 15th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
The right wing has come to use the expression gender ideology as a slur, as a way to portray gender identity as a position to be debated instead of an intrinsic human characteristic. It's their weapon against transgender people in particular. Transgender philosophy is the perfect deterrent, expertly wielded by Talia May Betcher. Boettcher is a professor at California State University, Los Angeles, where she chaired the philosophy department from 2012 to 2018. She also directed the Center for the Study of Genders and Sexualities. An activist as well as an academic, Boettcher has served on the Los Angeles Human Relations Commission's Transgender Advisory Council and with a policy working group on trans community relations for the Los Angeles Police Department. This Way Out's Tanya Kane Perry asked Boettcher to explain her core message.
Because your work is really about identity and trans philosophy, as you've mentioned in prior conversations we've had, before we jump into current events, I'd love to learn a little bit more about what is trans philosophy. What does that mean?
So first of all, Tanya, thank you. Thank you for having me on your program. And I really appreciate the opportunity because, like, right now, trans voices are so important. You know, they're trying to deny that we exist. Yeah. And so to let us speak, to hear our voices, to hear what we have to say, I think is absolutely crucial. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that people define trans philosophy in different ways. And I define it very simply. I define it as philosophizing in resistance to trans oppression. And you might ask yourself, well, what does philosophy have to do with resistance to oppression?
Exactly.
When you experience oppression, the world gets turned upside down. And people tell you that this is what common sense is. So there's a sense in which what is passed off as common sense doesn't make any sense at all. And you're trying to figure things out, and life is not making any sense to you. And you're not provided with the right concepts or tools to make sense of things. All right, enter philosophy, right? And so philosophy sometimes can provide an illuminating function. It can provide you with the tools to, like, okay, how am I going to make sense of this? How am I going to try to make sense of, like, this chaos? Right? And so I think that philosophy can do that. Philosophy, when used in particular ways, can be liberatory. And I think that trans philosophy can be liberatory. It is used usually by trans people, but also by trans allies to uncover and to illuminate, sometimes often to expose, you know, the ruses of oppression and to show us what's really going on.
So if we take, let's say, some of these insane executive orders saying trans women can no longer participate in women's sports, how then, from a trans philosophy, do you look at that to unpack that, to make sense of that, to go, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. This is oppressive.
Well, so first of all, I would say that's not what the executive order says, right? It says, I can't remember the exact words, but it has to do with preventing men from participating in women's sports.
Okay.
So, and this is the way they always gloss it. So the primary move is to say that trans women are men.
Okay.
And that's what they're doing in all cases.
Got it.
And so for me, you know, a lot of my research has been all about looking at that. So for me, like, you know, there's a primary form of transphobia that I call reality enforcement. And so, you know, trans folk are very much concerned about misgendering. And misgendering is sort of, you know, the application of concepts like man and woman, you know, in ways that go against a trans person's self-identity. So if you call a trans woman a man or a trans man a woman or a non-binary person anything other than non-binary, that's misgendering. But so for me, I wanted to look beyond the categories. I was very interested in ways in which trans people were viewed as, so for example, really a man disguised as a woman or really a man pretending to be a woman. Notice the really, so you get this appearance and reality contrast.
Right.
Well, as a philosopher, we love appearance and reality, really gets us going. Except the appearance and reality thing sort of sets it up so that trans people are either viewed as deceivers, pretending that we're something that we're not, or that we're pretending to be something that we're not. And so what I realized is that what the appearance is our public gender presentation.
Okay.
And what the reality is, and this is really interesting, what the reality is sort of the imagined genital status. Mm. What really got me onto this is when I focused on extreme cases of transphobic violence. Mm. What often happens is that trans people find themselves, you know, sort of exposed, their pants are pulled down, grabbed between their legs, right? Now, notice you're shaking your head, right? Because what you're noticing is that this is a violation, right?
Yeah, it's a violation. It's bodily violation, right, absolutely.
Right. Okay, so because we think that genitals have boundaries on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a way in which genitals are private parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And this is one of the things that got me thinking. So genitals constitute the reality.
Mm.
Okay. So what I think the reality is for them, for these folks who want to say that trans women are men, has ultimately to do with private parts. Mm. Now, they want to say that it has to do with chromosomes, gonads, all this kind of thing. Mm. But I think that it has to do with private parts. Mm.
So what do we do with this, right? So we understand this arbitrary moral panic. How do we, as community, do something about this?
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Brace yourself for Cal State University professor Talia Mae Boettcher's bold answer about what the queer community can do now.
If we were going to start planning kind of like, you know, radical actions, like really radical actions, and I was, you know, playing around with like, how can we like, I mean, we live in California, still a more or less kind of safe state, you know, but like if we were dealing with like, you know, like bathroom kind of laws and stuff like that, I think it would be interesting for non-trans women to start using the men's restroom, for instance.
As a way of protesting this whole idea of gender and genderized bathrooms and all of that, right?
Right. And just start really messing with it.
Mm-hmm.
In states in which trans women are sort of, their boundaries are considered male, they should technically be allowed to go around topless, right?
Right. Right, right, exactly. If they're considered male.
Of course, the anti-trans Nazis probably will use it against them anyway.
Right, of course. Because
but of course, like, if they're supposed to use male changing rooms, then presumably they should be allowed to go topless. So then they should be allowed to be, I don't know. But my point is, like,
if we can
find ways, and I also think, like, you know, like, if, like, trans guys really started to use the women's restroom, like, I'm talking, like, you know, like, seriously, have they ever really thought this through? Like, you know, heavily testosterone.
Well, and the attack seems to be repeatedly on trans women.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like, I rarely hear anyone talk about trans men.
We're back to the phase where it's all and only trans women who are visible and trans men who are utterly erased.
And how did that happen, or why is that happening again? Like,
I mean, it used to be that way. Then I think there was a period in which, like, you know, there was a greater visibility for individuals who are like trans masculine of center in general.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it's sort of like, I think that when you have a transphobic model of trans people, it just always seems to collapse into this sort of, on the one hand, erasure and invisibilization of like trans mask individuals, and then trans women and trans femme individuals are sort of like, get this really toxic visibility.
Why do you think that is?
Well, on the one hand, I think because you have already the hypervisibility of feminine gender presentation, right, which is already marked and sexualized,
right?
In a straight culture, let's say, right? In a queer culture, it's going to be different.
Mm.
But sort of mainstream heterosexual culture, you're going to have marked femme presentation.
Right.
And that's going to be titillating,
right?
And then also in a sort of heterosexual context, sort of like the ultimate taboo in terms of nudity is full frontal male, right?
Mm.
So you put those two together, that's one of the reasons, I think. I think it's probably more complicated, but that's one reason.
Mm. Wow, fascinating. And so I love this idea of allies, like, you know, femme-presenting women going in and using male bathrooms, and likewise allies who are presenting as male going into women's bathrooms, right, and challenging all that. In an earlier conversation you and I had, you stated that trans folks are the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate on that?
There may be particular issues concerning trans people that those who are pushing Project 2025 are concerned about. But obviously, they're not going to stop with trans people.
Right.
You know, how trans people fare, you know, how we go, that we're sort of like, we're like a test case.
Right.
Right? And, you know, already they're talking about, you know, overturning, you know, doing, test case for like same-sex marriage.
Right.
Right? So that's next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're already trying to divide, you know, LGBT folks against trans folks. And but once they have, you know, trans folks safely put away,
mm-hmm.
the next move was definitely going to be LGBT folks.
Yeah. So, in a sense, if we don't fight for trans people and trans rights, whoever we are, we're essentially all putting ourselves at danger.
Right. They're going to go, I mean, I would say, and not just LGBT folks, they're going to go after women.
They're going to go after contraception and women.
Right.
And
exactly. They're going to go after Griswold. I mean,
yeah.
Of course. That's,
they're going to go, next thing I know, we won't have our own bank accounts.
Exactly. I mean, it's going to be, you know, Handmaid's Tale. But
yeah.
You won't be able to flee to Canada because that's going to be the 51st state.
There you go. Exactly. So again, that's why it's so important for me that we're having this conversation, because when we recognize this is the canary in the coal mine, this is the alarm going off, and this is a chance for all of us to push back now and save everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Whether you feel like a super fan of trans people or not, regardless, you need to be out there. Because this is about, at the end of the day, everybody.
Trans people are low-hanging fruit. We're very easy. There's not that many of us. It's easy to go, like, to do the transphobic slur. Oh, my God, you have these men putting on wigs, and they're like beating up on women on these sports teams, right? It's very easy to do the, like, the South Park caricature,
right,
and get people mad,
yeah,
and distort the reality of the actual experience of trans women. And it's very easy to vilify then trans people and then to start persecuting them.
Right.
And but it's like a test case. If you can motivate people and get them okay with persecuting one group of people,
mm-hmm.
you can get them okay with persecuting other groups of people.
Exactly.
And that's kind of where we are right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think that, you know, people have drawn these analogies. I mean, it's not the first time in history that trans people have been persecuted.
Right.
I mean, trans people were persecuted, you know, in Nazi Germany.
Exactly.
Right? And one of the things that, you know, I will say as a trans Canadian living in the U.S.,
mm.
I don't find it strange that trans people are being persecuted. I will say, you must surely realize that what is happening in this country is not normal. And so take what is happening to trans people in a larger context.
Right.
When you have a president who says he wants to annex Canada, please realize that what is happening is not normal. When the only movies that have ever been about the U.S. invading Canada, there have been two that I know of, have been comedies. And he is seriously promising an economic war with the plan of ultimately invading Canada. And this is something that the federal government of Canada is taking seriously,
yes,
as a real threat.
Yes.
I say to you, you have to take this seriously. This is not normal. That you must then take the threat on trans people within that political context and realize that this is no joke.
Right. Exactly.
Can I also say that really bodes ill for my plan of escape?
Right, because your plan of escape was to go home to Canada. Yes. And that's not going to work out anymore. Yeah, right. You're not the only one. Lots of people are actually talking about ways to leave.
No, most all of my friends that I know of are talking about, like, plan B, how to get out of the country.
Right, yeah.
Never ask for no one's philosophy. It's obvious, so proud of me. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Cal State Los Angeles University philosophy professor Talia May Betcher's new book will be out this week. It's called Beyond Personhood, an Essay in Trans Philosophy, published by University of Minnesota Press. She was interviewed for This Way Out by Tanya Kane Perry. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Tanya Kane Perry and Michael LeBeau, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was Tanya Kane Perry. Van Morrison, Shea Diamond, and CJ Beards performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Daniel Wasillas. Thanks for listening, online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on Fresh FM, Nelson Tasman Blenheim Eastern Golden Bay, New Zealand, KTAL, Las Cruces, New Mexico, WTND, Macomb, Illinois, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
K282BH, Philomer, on 104.3 FM.
And K220HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM.
And streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO.
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 Hey, KBOO listeners. Come join us Friday, April 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. here at the station for KBOO's April Fools for Fools First Friday Arts Walk for the eccentrics, the clowns, and the freaks. Enjoy an evening of art, live music, vendors, performers, food, drinks, and more. That's Friday, April 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Ave, Portland, Oregon. Can't wait to see you there.
Even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times, I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now. I want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Two young men in Indonesia to be flogged for gay sex. A UK appeals court nixes a non-binary gender marker. And building a joyful transmasculine community. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With News Wrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Two young men in the Indonesian province of Aceh are to be publicly beaten with a cane for having gay sex. They were arrested on November 7th after anti-queer vigilantes broke into their rented room and discovered them naked and hugging each other. Under Islamic law, they were tried for morality offenses. The 18 and 24-year-old college students were sentenced to 80 and 85 lashes, respectively. Sakawana is the single name of the judge overseeing the trial. That's a custom for many Indonesians. Her ruling found, during the trial, it was proven that the defendants committed illicit acts, including kissing and having sex. While the maximum penalty is 100 lashings in public and up to 8 years in prison, Sakwana lessened the sentences because neither had a police record. Both were polite in court, and they are otherwise considered to be outstanding students. The older of the two will be flogged the most. The pair accepted their sentences without appeal. Sharia has been the law in Aceh province since a 2006 dispute with federal authorities allowed it to adopt Islamic legal practice. The rest of Indonesia is governed by secular laws. More than 100 people each year in the province have been publicly caned for various morality offenses. The scheduled public caning in Aceh comes on the heels of last week's raid on what authorities called a gay sex party in Jakarta. 56 men were arrested in a private hotel room and charged with violating the country's secular laws against obscenity and pornography.
British law does not recognize non-binary as a gender, according to the United Kingdom Court of Appeal. Cybersecurity expert Ryan Castellucci moved from Los Angeles in 2019. They obtained legal recognition as non-binary in California in 2021 and were issued a U.S. passport listing their gender as X the following year. They tried to have their gender recorded as non-binary on a U.K. gender recognition certificate, a document which changes someone's legal sex. They lost the bid in an earlier high court challenge. Meanwhile, a Trump administration executive order has eliminated the X-gender passport option. Lord Justice Singh deferred to Parliament in dismissing the appeal, saying that the UK's two-gender policy was up to lawmakers to address, not the judiciary. Castellucci called their efforts to be legally recognized as non-binary an ordeal, but their lawyers say they are considering a further appeal. At 30-something, they're looking ahead, saying, "I plan to live the rest of my life here and eventually die here. Being denied the dignity of knowing my death certificate will be correct makes my stomach turn."
Iowa's transgender people are no longer protected from discrimination. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a bill that revokes the addition of gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Thus, the current Republican-dominated state legislature has undone the statute by the previous Democratic administration and affirmed by the state Supreme Court in 2022. Hundreds of people rallied at the state Capitol building to protest the bill's imminent passage.
We are trans, like we're together, and we are singing for our lives.
Iowa's legislature ignored the voices of the people. The Republicans argued that revoking gender identity protections in civil rights laws will make it easier for the state to defend its other anti-trans laws, such as the ban on trans student competitors in female sports. That's already being challenged in court. Iowa is now the first state in U.S. history to excise a class originally granted civil rights protection. Max Mowitz of queer advocacy group One Iowa told the Des Moines Register, "This law will cause real harm, making daily life harder and more uncertain for countless Iowans who simply want to live openly and authentically. History will not look kindly on this moment."
Two executive orders by U.S. President Donald Trump that threaten the civil rights of LGBTQ people and other U.S. citizens are already being roadblocked in court. Maryland-based U.S. District Judge Adam B. Abelson said that the key provisions targeting federal agencies and federal-funded diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in higher education and the private sector were impermissibly vague and threatened to chill constitutionally protected speech and activity. Abelson issued a preliminary injunction this week blocking their enforcement. The ruling noted that the administration's effort to uproot DEI programs failed to define key terms, such as equity-related and illegal DEI. Abelson was not convinced that the order was necessary to root out illegal discrimination. This challenge is being led by national education groups and the city of Baltimore. At least one other lawsuit against the anti-diversity order has been filed by Lambda Legal and the Legal Defense Fund on behalf of the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and AIDS Foundation Chicago.
The block on a second Trump order is keeping transgender women in U.S. women's prisons from being transferred to men's prisons. That action was to comply with the Trump decree that U.S. law recognizes only two genders, male and female. Washington, D.C.-based U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that the move would violate trans women's constitutional rights and put them in jeopardy of serious harm. Lamberth had previously issued an order to protect three trans women inmates from imminent transfer. The latest ruling expands that protection to nine additional plaintiffs who were rounded up by Bureau of Prison officials and told they would be immediately transferred to men's prisons, according to court filings. The Trump order also terminates current gender-affirming health care for trans inmates. The judge believes the lawsuit challenging the Trump anti-trans order is likely to be overturned on Eighth Amendment protections against imposing excessive bail, excessive fines, or cruel and unusual punishments. Judge Lamberth questioned the Trump administration's motives. He wrote that the order would exacerbate the symptoms of their gender dysphoria, even if they are not subject to physical or sexual violence in their new facility, whether because they will be subject to searches by male correctional officers, made to shower in the company of men, referred to as men.
The U.S. Supreme Court is letting Tennessee's virtual ban on drag performances stand. On February 24th, it decided not to hear a case challenging the law. The legislation was enacted by the Republican-controlled state in 2023. It was ruled unconstitutionally vague and substantially overbroad by a judge on the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee. However, last July, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision on a technicality. The top court has now let stand its finding that the complainant, Friends of George Incorporated Drag Theater Company of Memphis, lacked the legal standing to sue. Another lawsuit challenging Tennessee's drag ban is still working its way through the U.S. judicial system. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on behalf of Blount County Pride organizers because the law threatened prosecution of any violators during its 2023 Pride Festival.
Finally, however, there was one hearing the U.S. High Court did hold this week. The reverse discrimination case of a straight, white, cisgender woman who claims that she was denied a promotion and demoted after allegedly less qualified queer colleagues gained positions ahead of her. 60-year-old Marlene Ames worked for years for the Ohio Department of Youth Services, the state's juvenile justice system. A lower appeals court ruled in her case that a so-called majority group plaintiff must meet a higher evidentiary standard than plaintiffs in other bias cases. In other words, it's harder for heterosexual workers to prove discrimination based on sexual orientation or for white employees claiming racial bias. The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling before the current term ends in late June. A number of civil rights groups are deeply concerned that a win for Ames could open a Pandora's box of countless reverse discrimination cases, and that could be especially dangerous in the current climate against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Shazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
and through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
There's a giant eraser moving across the USA, and the letters T and Q are disappearing from the government's LGBTQ-related websites and publications. The Trump administration has even wiped any mention of transgender people from the signage outside the Stonewall National Monument, despite the fact that it was trans activists who launched the 1969 rebellion it memorializes. While conservative politicians are using their network of far-right media outlets to power the transphobic purge, This Way Out's David Hunt met one New York college student who's focused on a new kind of narrative, the history and the joy of transmasculine community building.
In an open letter to the academic community in the summer of 2009, scholar Eve Tuck urged educators to reconsider the impact of what she called damage-centered research, work that focuses on people's pain and brokenness to hold those in power accountable for their oppression. "It may be well-intentioned," she wrote, "but this type of research reinforces and reinscribes a one-dimensional notion of people as depleted, ruined, and hopeless." Instead, she said, "Academics should seek to understand the complexity, contradiction, and self-determination of the people they study. Focus on their desires, not their damage," she said. As Tuck wrote those words, seated at a little table in her Hudson Valley, New York home, a young tomboy in rural Pennsylvania looked up at the night sky, caught a glimpse of a shooting star, and made a wish. "I hope I wake up
tomorrow and I'm a boy."
I'm David Hunt. Eli Butler's wish did come true, eventually. The Pennsylvania tomboy is now a 22-year-old transgender man, living in New York City, and conducting academic research of his own. Research centered on the joy of being transmasculine. Research influenced by the scholarship of Eve Tuck, and inspired by the transmasculine activists who paved his way. "I no longer want damage to be the focus of research about trans communities," Butler said in his senior thesis for a degree in peace and justice studies. "I want to shift the research narrative toward possibility." I sat down with Butler to discuss his life, his research, and the possibilities of the future.
I love being trans. Like, I've enjoyed this journey. I think that life is like, and for everybody, is just kind of learning more about yourself every day and like making changes in your life that accompany that. So I'm like still figuring out who I am as a trans person every day.
That's not to say the Pace University undergraduate's life is free from oppression. On the day we talked, the National Park Service was busy rewriting history, erasing the story of the transgender activists who led the 1969 protests at the Stonewall Inn, what is now the Stonewall National Monument, less than 2 miles from the Pace University campus in New York. But the Trump administration's efforts to legally extinguish the visibility, even the very existence, of transgender people has galvanized the community. More than 1,000 protesters rallied at the historic site on February 14th to decry the Park Service's erasure of trans history. It seemed fitting that this demonstration of loud and proud queer community should happen while Butler and I discussed the focus of his senior thesis, community building by transmasculine people, past and present. In researching his thesis at the New York Public Library and in archives of transgender publications and organizations, Butler discovered that transmasculine community building has a rich and layered history going back generations.
I think that, like, a lot of times we think that trans people were all underground until the 2000s or until the late 90s. But that was not the case. And reading these newsletters was like, wow, they've been telling us that we haven't existed until now. Like, we have existed and been loud about it for decades now.
The literature review section of Butler's thesis is a history lesson, chronicling the contributions of trans men who are largely unknown and unappreciated today, including Steve Dane, who made headlines in the late 1970s after transitioning and being fired from his job as a public high school teacher, and Mario Martino, who established a counseling service for trans men called Labyrinth in 1968.
It was really heartwarming to me to see the ways that different trans guys talked about themselves and talked about the other trans guys that they were with, how similar it was to experiences that I've had and other people had. I just think there's so many similarities, even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times. I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now.
To learn more about community building by trans masculine men today, Butler interviewed three trans men, a licensed therapist in a southern state who facilitates a virtual trans masculine support group, the leader of the Louisville Trans Masculine Alliance in Kentucky, and a counselor for the Virginia Tech chapter of Delta Lambda Phi, a fraternity for gay, bisexual, transgender, and progressive men. Among Butler's findings, masculinity can be problematic.
I see a lot of stuff online from people who are like, you're going to the dark side, like when you're transitioning into a masculine identity. And so I think a lot of masculine people like feel discouraged by that, and they want to be around people who also see masculinity more in a more positive light.
Butler found that community building evolved as a survival tactic to create spaces of support and understanding among an astoundingly underrepresented and isolated group. And he demonstrated that community building is affected by differences in geography and organizing styles.
I mean, there are similarities between all of the groups for sure, but you know, based on the different focuses of these groups, you're having different community building experiences. So like one of these was this like trans masculine frat. And so, you know, building community in a frat is so much different than building community in a support group. Like you're talking about different things, you're focusing on different things, but there is like this general relation between everybody. Even these groups that are so different in how they go about building community, they are talking about and focusing on similar things. They're just going about it in different ways.
A nearly universal advantage of community building, Butler found, is its role in healing trauma. Trauma isolates. The group recreates a sense of belonging, Butler explained, referencing the work of American psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman.
I read a lot of books from therapists and psychiatrists about how building community heals trauma, which I think is especially important in the trans community, which even if you're a trans person that hasn't experienced any kind of personal transphobia, you know, you're living in this society which is just violently transphobic. So building community like allows you to heal those wounds in a certain way. You're now in a place where people understand you. They understand your trauma. Maybe they've been through similar things, or in the broader way, they understand exactly the feelings that you're feeling, and you can process that trauma together. And that is the healing power of community.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Eli Butler about his research into transmasculine community building. Butler's academic work is informed by his personal journey as a transgender man. That journey began at an early age.
I actually realized I was trans when I was in the fourth grade. I think I was around 8 years old. I changed my name. I went through like kind of a social transition, which is kind of the most that a lot of younger kids can do. I wore, you know, more masculine clothing. I went by a different name. I went by different pronouns. That was so against the status quo. Not that like being trans isn't against the status quo already, but you know, for someone so young. And so I was kind of like, I want to say forced out of that, or like kind of pressure was put on me to grow out of that. And so I went back to living as a woman and identifying as a woman until around COVID. And COVID was really the time when I had time to sit with myself. And I feel like this happened to a lot of people. It was like the first time you were forced to be alone with your thoughts and really like reflect on how you see yourself, how you see the world. And that's when I realized that I was non-binary. And then when I finally came to college, I realized that I was more binary masculine than I thought I was at first.
But even in New York, a metropolis with one of the world's largest LGBTQ populations, Butler discovered that something was missing in his life.
I mean, I think of New York in terms of like the gay revolution of the 70s, expecting it to be like full of activities and clubs and groups of people that just like were so like out and proud about their queerness or their transness. And I came to New York and to a liberal arts college thinking that's how it would be. I would find my people who understood me and it would just be so easy. And it was not. And I actually found a lack of transmasculine, specifically groups in New York City.
It was that experience, the longing for community, that led Butler to focus his senior thesis on transmasculine community building. In doing that, he discovered the challenges as well as the joys of creating change.
One of my interviewees said something that really struck me, and this is how I think of how strengthening community needs to be now, which is that community is a two-way street. You're not just coming to the community or trying to find a community when you need help. You're there all the time. You're there to support people when they need help, and then so that when you need help, you can come to them.
Now that his senior thesis is done, Butler has the time to focus on some community building of his own. He's spearheading a project to create a quilt of trans joy, a project inspired by the Norfolk Trans Joy Community Quilt, a project led by partners Bo Brannick and Alice Bigsby Bye in the United Kingdom.
I am holding workshops where trans people, trans students can come in and, you know, their allies, their loved ones, or their friends can come in, make a quilt square. Then it's going to be this big quilt of like trans joy. And it's going to be put up in the LGBTQ center at the school and whatnot. So it's like, it's half this like community building and art focused kind of project. And it's also half like a political resistance kind of message.
At the end of the day, Butler explained, building community is about finding your people and finding your joy.
I can't imagine being a young trans person right now, looking at the news and being like, wow, like, my identity is all based in suffering, because that's a lot of times what it seems like. I've had younger trans people like in my life say this to me, where they're like, you seem like you like being trans. Like, can you tell me that it gets better? I like want to be living proof to younger trans people that like, you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
I'd like to thank Eli Butler for sharing his story for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Joe Bainline and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Seals and Croft, T. Ricky, J. Patrick Lemieux, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WCRX, Chicago, Illinois, CJLY, Nelson Crawford Bay, New Denver, British Columbia, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4.